You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 6th of November 2017 on Monocle 24. Live from London, this is Midori House with me, Tom Edwards. Coming up today...
This is an individual who was described as a lone wolf. I don't know how it could have been prevented if we didn't have any prior knowledge to this individual. It wasn't evident that he had weapons in his room. We have determined that there has been employees going to and fro from his room, and nothing nefarious was noticed.
Are mass shootings an unavoidable phenomenon? While the gun lobby rushes to block legislative efforts in the wake of the massacre in Las Vegas, we'll look at the reality behind some sneaky statistics. Also ahead.
I think the Prime Minister showed enormous grace and real grit during the course of this week, and she secured more votes in the general election than any Conservative leader has since 1983.
But one you will also be aware that in that election, her rival, Jeremy Corbyn, secured just a fraction less than her. And it's because...
Yes, he came second, yes.
A bump in support for Britain's once unlikely opposition leader might not quite have secured Labour's victory at the next election, but with the ruling Conservative Party in chaos, are the gears shifting faster than PM Theresa May yet realises? My guests, Matt Alagaya, Daniel Giacopelli and Carlotta Ribello, will be discussing this and the day's other top stories, including the Catalan rush to stop a mass business exodus, and what's the real meaning of the Nobel Peace Prize? That's all to come here on Midori House with me, Tom Edwards. A warm welcome to Midori House and a warm welcome to my guests who are Matt Alagaya, Daniel Giacopelli and Carlotta Ribello. To the three of you, welcome.
Hello, Tom.
Thank you very much.
A little more enthusiasm.
I'm here.
You're adoring fans.
Let's start in the United States. Senator John McCain of Arizona, Senator Richard Burr of North Carolina, Congressman French Hill of Arkansas. These are just some of the U.S. elected officials whose political careers have benefited, more than many others, from funds courtesy of the National Rifle Association. In the wake of just about every mass shooting in the U.S., talk of reforming the nation's famously libertarian gun laws is inevitably shut down. This week, however, despite whispers that even the NRA itself might support legislative action to prevent the firearm modification used by the gunman in Las Vegas to turn his semi-automatic weapon more or less fully automatic, the White House was busy explaining why regulatory intervention may not be the answer.
One of the things that we don't want to do is try to create laws that won't create or stop these types of things from happening. I think if you look to Chicago, where you had over 4,000 victims of gun-related crimes last year, they have the strictest gun laws in the country. That certainly hasn't helped there.
There you go, Danny. You can't argue with Sarah Huckabee. No legislation.
No, of course not.
Could do anything to stop the kind of instance we've seen. After almost every one of these gun atrocities in the U.S., the same conversation is had, well, nothing will change. There is a hint, a possibility of some legislation covering certain facets of what we saw, but it's completely fair to say that nothing meaningful will change.
Well, yeah, so for the first time, the NRA has come out in favor of some small form of gun control in that they might want to regulate these bump stock things, which allow you to fire something, a semi-automatic to be almost fully automatic. And it's kind of bizarre that they're almost even legal right now, but it is the first time that they kind of gave a little bit of ground. But you have to also remember the big picture in that even if that does pass, nothing will change because the vast majority of gun crime in the U.S. are from pistols, not these kind of military-grade weapons. So even if you do, for some reason, outlaw this bump stock thing, and even if you do outlaw semi-automatic weapons, you're still going to have a vast number of gun crimes from pistols.
I love how the wording on the statement from the NRA, because they didn't ask or they didn't explicitly call on Congress to act, which was just more of a recommendation for the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco and Firearms to look into the legislation, which is quite funny because the ATF is controlled by the NRA. Mm. So it's way more for show, in my opinion, than to anything else. Say, hey, look, we're actually not the bad guys in this instance. But I can't believe that it's anything more than just fireworks.
And Matt, isn't that the problem here? The NRA have long proven very capable at trying to score PR victories in a manner similar, I guess, to how Trump runs his day-to-day operations, which is to sort of win the day in headline terms. That's what they do. And they know that stocks in Smith & Wesson and the like surge after these attacks, gun purchases surge, ammo sales surge, bump stock sales surge in the immediate aftermath, which is almost incomprehensible to me. Isn't the problem here that you have to go right back to the source, and we have to start talking about the Second Amendment itself to understand why guns occupy this place in sort of American culture and why it's such an intractable issue, even though we constantly get driven back to trying to ask the question?
Absolutely. I mean, there was a fantastic piece today in The Guardian by Gary Young, who basically talked about the fact that this myth at the center of American society is about individualism. It's about control. It's about looking after your family. And it comes back to, you know, everything from big government versus small government. You know, in Europe, we kind of cede a lot of our rights to government and say, you know, you're going to look after us. In America, it's the exact opposite. You know, they don't want government looking after them. It's small government, and you have to protect you and yours in your own home. And it's a really powerful myth, but a myth is exactly what it is. And his piece basically makes that very, very clear. I mean, just simply, you know, I think one of the interesting things is after, you know, what is obviously a horrible mass shooting, the papers all for a couple of days focus on the human stories. And now they're getting into the real nitty-gritty and making the arguments of why gun control is essential. And the New York Times has just excelled at basically doing infographics and things to just show how big a problem this is. And there was a piece today in the New York Times on the website about the number of days you have to go back in history in certain cities in the US to see how many people have been killed, the same number as Las Vegas in that one evening. And, you know, in Detroit, it's 28 days and you've already got 58 killings in shootings. So there's just a lot of evidence that shows you that it's crazy and you need gun laws. And it's starting, well, yeah, I mean, all the people who always say it are saying it. But yeah, as we've said already, the NRA is so strong.
Well, we'll drill down maybe more into that data as well. There's certain facts that go beyond merely being arresting, like the fact that almost double the number of people who perished tragically in the Vegas attack have died since in other shootings, including mass shootings in the US just in the few days since. But Danny, it's interesting, Matt was talking there about forums where you would expect to see those kind of narratives, but there have been some unexpected voices as well throwing their hat into the ring. And we were talking a little earlier today, actually, about a voice, well, a notorious voice, I guess, probably on the sort of right-leaning side, the even more right-leaning side.
Well, he's not notorious. I mean, so Bret Stephens, he's a conservative. I mean, but he's not a loon. He's not like kind of...
I simply said he had notoriety.
No. I'm saying he's a centre-right guy. He's like the New York Times kind of token conservative.
He's not on board with climate change, though, for example.
He is bizarrely...
So I doubt say he and Gary Young would get along very well.
He's a climate change denier, but he's not a crazy person. You have to have these kind of small distinctions.
And yet, if you read his op-ed piece, I think which was in today's paper,
it was
very striking.
It was a day or two ago, so it was called Repeal the Second Amendment, and it's kind of a brief little essay of him laying out in very simple terms why we should repeal the Second Amendment. And that's actually going far beyond... So a lot of people, a lot of like liberals lose this war of words because they actually say, oh, we should get rid of the Second Amendment. That's probably never going to happen.
But the point of his piece is that...
The point of his piece is it actually could happen. But
is meddling around and nuanced legislation that addresses one area or another is all a waste of time. And it would only be a full repeal that could actually deliver...
Yeah.
And ultimately, this is what we're talking about, safety to American citizens.
Well, yeah, his whole thing is that, you know, from a personal safety standpoint, more guns means less safety. That's just proven. That's a proven stat. The more guns there are, the more deaths there are. From a national security standpoint, I mean, you look at the Constitution, it says nothing about the right of a person to have a gun. It's all about the right of a well-armed militia, which was around in the 1700s. Of course, we don't have militias anymore. And from a personal liberty standpoint, there's no, having like the Whiskey Rebellion of the 1790s, the New York Draft Riots, the Coal Miners Rebellion, the Brinks Robbery of 1981, Bret Stephens is saying these aren't moments, great moments of Second Amendment activism. So it's not like the people are rising up against a tyrannical government. It's more kind of like criminal acts and riots is what's happening with like Second Amendment rights. So he's saying the only thing you can do is repeal the whole goddamn thing, which will take a lot of time and effort.
It reminds me a bit of the early 1930s when the rise of the gangsters and the mob was on the rise in the US. And at the time, Congress held hearings on severely restrict firearms sales. And one of the many testimonies that we heard at the time was from the then president of the NRA, Carl T. Frederick. And I have a quote here from this transcript. "I have never believed in the general practice of carrying weapons. I think it should be sharply restricted and only under licenses." To think of the president of the NRA any time in the last 20 years to make these statements. And it goes back to the point of the piece you're just mentioning, Danny, that there has never been written that is for personal use. And this is exactly the point that at the time when people were getting killed every day, almost every hour, by gun violence, was one of the things that the NRA was advocating for. And it just makes me wonder, with such a testimony from the lobby that basically controls the halt on this legislation and why it doesn't go forward, the restrictions, what happened there in the early 1930s for it not to go ahead?
Yeah, and Tom, we were talking about this in this piece before, and we were talking about the last paragraph of Bret Stephens' piece, and he says, I mean, he's talking about one of the founding fathers, James Madison. He says, "I wonder what Madison would have to say about that today, when more than twice as many Americans perished last year at the hands of their fellows as died in the entire Revolutionary War." And he said, "My guess, take the guns, or at least their presumptive right to them, take them away. The true foundation of American exceptionalism should be our capacity for moral and constitutional renewal, not our instinct for self-destruction." And I think it's a pretty powerful ending to that essay.
Powerful stuff. And if we look at moral assertions here, Matt, where maybe Trump's not the person we need to look to, but where's he left in this? Because he talked, and I know he's committed vault fasces left and right throughout his whole career, certainly during the campaign. He previously advocated tightening of controls on all sorts of long-barreled weapons, semi-automatic rifles and so forth. He reined back on that significantly during his campaign when, perhaps purely coincidentally, he also enjoyed $30 million of campaign financing from the NRA. Now, clearly, looking at that objectively from outside, it seems like he's hamstrung. But could this be the sort of thing that would pique his interest? Maybe he is interested in a legacy. Maybe he is interested in trying to achieve something that no president in the modern age has been able to. And, you know, Obama famously brought practically to tears at his own impotence in this area. Is there any chance that Trump might intervene in a surprisingly positive way?
Not likely, I don't think. One of the most interesting infographics I've seen today was that no other issue divides people more than gun ownership. So if you look at a map of America and take just households that own guns, apart from one state, all of them voted Trump. If you take just households that don't own guns, all of them bar one voted for Hillary Clinton. It is the single issue that you can say divides the country down the middle between Democrat and Republican. And Trump owes his victory to the people who staunchly believe in gun ownership. And for that reason, there's absolutely no way, I think, he will ever think of that as part of his legacy. And he's already said, you know, we're not going to talk about that. He's already kind of pushed that into the long grass. And I doubt that he's gonna try and never revisit it.
And I think also, just as a final thing, I mean, liberals, as they are, have to kind of win the war of words here because, you know, people living.
But is there any point to that?
Well, hold on.
To go back to that point that Bret Stephens was making, that's pointless, isn't it? That is the very definition of empty rhetoric.
Well, it's because people living in like North London and like Brooklyn, they don't know the difference between a rifle and a pistol and a shotgun, and you know what I mean. It's kind of there's this like literal cultural divide where, quote unquote, liberals on the left, they don't know how to even talk about this stuff. They don't realize that more people die from pistols. They don't know what a semi-automatic means. They don't know what ammunition is, what a round is, and it's kind of you're losing this cultural.
True? I think you're being slightly disingenuous there.
Well, if you go to some like the heart of America where everybody has guns, they grow up with guns and they know how to talk about them. And how do you legislate something when you don't even know what the hell you're talking about? I really think there's like a cultural divide in America where it's hard to kind of jump over that divide.
And there's also the clip we heard at the beginning of the program when the Las Vegas sheriff was saying, oh, there's no way this could have been prevented. We're talking of someone that had more than 30 firearms in his room. And that's part of these statistics and what we've been discussing about America's gun super owners. You know, out of the 265 million guns that are owned legally in America, 130 million belong to 3% of Americans. These are people that own from 8 firearms to 140. And that's a striking number. So how could have this been prevented? Maybe there's a limit in how many weapons you can have. It's just, when hearing that, I just can't help but shake my head and think that's not a real answer.
Indeed. Let's move on. Now, when Britain shocked the world by voting to leave the EU, attention quickly turned to what the impact might be upon London, in particular's business community. It was a similar story in Quebec. Despite ultimately voting to remain part of Canada, years of uncertainty was enough to convince banks and other big businesses to move on. Now, as Catalonia rushes to calm the waters following the state's vote for independence, the government is busy setting up a committee to try and prevent a mass exodus of businesses should any kind of formal declaration be made. And just before we came on air, in fact, the third largest bank, previously based in Catalonia, announced it was moving to Valencia. So it's already happening. Carlotta, it does often seem that almost at the brink of secession or at the brink of a collective popular movement to break away, certain economic realities often seem to compel people to step back from the brink. Sadly, re-Brexit, it didn't work. But we've seen it in secessionist cases so often before. Is this case different?
I'm not exactly sure if it's different, but I don't think all the consequences have been measured the right way, because this has been such an emotional issue for citizens from Catalonia for so many decades, and for the last 40 years since Franco stepped out of power. Now, this move by CaixaBank, which is curious, because CaixaBank, the third largest bank in Spain, is domestically focused. So I wonder how that will work in terms of operations, because they're going to be operating outside of the region when most of their clients are from Catalonia. Now, I understand the business concerns, but that duality, I want to see what happens.
And we should say, I mean, it's the nominal location of the headquarters, so it's an absolute severance or anything like that.
But it's funny, because they couldn't do this without the regional MPs approving the move. Late yesterday and this morning, the Spanish government had been working on the legislation to use one of the royal decrees that would be able to change the law for them to facilitate this move. And right before we came on air, that law had been approved. The royal decree had been used. And a couple of minutes later, CaixaBank announced that their statutes had now finally been modified for them to change not only their legal, but also their tax base from Barcelona to Valencia. So I really wonder what's going to happen in terms of the actual clients when, in comparison to Banco Sabadell, the other largest bank in Catalonia, which is internationally focused, actually has subsidiaries here in the UK, this one is just domestic. So what is the point if most of your clients are in the region you're now departing?
Matt, I guess we've been charting this on the radio all week, the vitriol, the anger, the literal violence that this has prompted perhaps took some by surprise, though maybe we shouldn't be surprised given we had Castilian police being dispatched to Catalonia and so on and so forth. Have you been surprised by how quickly and sort of vehemently these other fronts have opened up, be it about business, be it about, you know, compelling companies to move their headquarters, this sort of thing? It seems like there's a constant rush to up the ante that's coming from Madrid and from within the region.
I mean, to my mind, I think it's all a reflection of a fairly inept approach by the Spanish government. I mean, the idea that, the King Felipe comes on national television, was it last night or the night before?
Yeah, 2 nights ago.
And he had a chance there. And it's really the duty of the monarch to bring the entire country together. And it was basically, he sort of chastised the Catalan authorities. And, he made it even more clear that they shouldn't really feel like the Spanish government is working for them. And I think that the Spanish government has kind of missed every single opportunity to bring people together and acknowledge the fact that, people from Catalonia don't feel like they're being heard. So my feeling is that it's actually, it's sort of ineptitude that has led to this. And now, as you say, we're in this very rapid escalation. And I think business is going to do whatever is easiest for it. So it's probably, that's less of an escalation on anyone's part politically, but the escalation of business is being facilitated by each side. And so it is kind of crazy to hear that the Spanish government is using this royal decree because it's just escalating things. It's just making it worse.
There's an interesting angle to all of this, at least in the middle of it all. It was about the Barcelona Football Club. Now, how will this secession affect the club? Will it have to leave La Liga? There's already talk that it could join, if the Catalan independence goes ahead, that it could join the English Premier League. But also, you know, they've been quite pondered in their comments and saying, we stand with Catalans, not exactly with independence or against it, but with the people from Catalonia. But the club, the team, did join the strike, that massive strike that happened on Tuesday, that basically brought the entire region to a standstill. And that was a direct protest to the violence. It wasn't against or in favour of the result, but towards the violence, which indeed I think is what has been shocking the world, because as today we were hearing comments from the European Union, it just seems like it's at the brink of civil war right in the middle of Europe. Now, the president of Barça, the football club, already said that the board of Barcelona has to consider the option of leaving and what that means. But he has demanded talks between the regional government and the Spanish government, which I think is quite amazing because we were talking about business earlier. And it's not only a massive club that brings tourists, millions of tourists every year to the region and to the city, but also a big generator of business and employment. So there's an interesting angle there for us to look at as well.
I think sport, soft power of sport, and almost quite hard power, we've seen it in these US demonstrations, and I think with Barcelona, always interesting. Something to return to. Let's move on, though. Now, it was, by almost any definition, a pretty disastrous affair this week when Britain's Prime Minister Theresa May delivered what was intended to be a rousing speech to her Conservative Party colleagues. But after a coughing fit, a pretty ineffective lozenge, a prankster presenting her with a bogus P45 and a stage set that ought to warrant a refund, if nothing else, whispers are quickly turning to whether the sheer lack of enthusiasm for the Tories might have whetted appetites for the previously unthinkable Prime Minister Jeremy Corbyn. Danny, you are a citizen of a nation that has well, 2 years ago it was the punchline to a joke. Literally, it was the topic of an episode of The Simpsons. Now it's the reality. Is this what's around the corner for Britain? Do you sense, I don't know, maybe similar domestic political narratives?
Yeah, but you can't compare the two at all. I mean, Jeremy Corbyn's a serious man, albeit with...
You can compare the
maybe extreme politics.
But the improbability of it.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. Can you? I don't know what the odds are. What are the odds are on Jeremy Corbyn these days?
I don't
know.
Are have
you a betting man?
He's favourite now. He's favourite to
really?
Prime Minister. Yeah.
That is extraordinary. He's from my home turf too in London, Tom. He's an Islington man.
He was my MP too for a number of years. Upper Holloway.
Could he be PM? I guess so. I mean, I think it's just radically different than a Donald Trump. I mean, I don't know where like the political winds are really shifting here in the UK. I mean, are they're not really right wing anymore, but they're not certainly not far left at all, right? I mean, what would you say?
This is the point.
Back in the 80s, of course, and like Thatcher
era. This is a
fringe
leftist. If you look at Corbyn's position going back to the late 70s and early 80s, it's absolutely what you're describing.
Nationalize everything.
Well, that's part and parcel of their explicit policy, should they win. Matt, what do you make of this? And I wonder, there's often a tendency to look at, say, party conference season, and obviously the newspapers, particularly on the extremes at either side, get very exercised by what they see. But this year's iterations have seemed somehow different. The Labour Party conference was like Glastonbury, and I have literally not seen a party conference like the Tories this year. Were you struck by that as well?
Absolutely. I mean, the Tory conference was a sad and very, very slow affair. And I mean, there are a few myths that always go around British politics, and I think one of them is that the longer you're in power, the more it ruins your party. You know, we saw that with the Labour Party, 15 years in power. By the end, it was a complete wreck. It seems to have gone through kind of hyperspeed with the Tories. You know, I think Brexit has brought it to a head much quicker. But, you know, 7 years ago, they were surging into power, albeit with the support of the Lib Dems, with David Cameron, this incredibly enthusiastic young guy at the helm. And now you see this the lineup of politicians on the front bench with Theresa May and that speech. And that's the other myth about British politics, is that bad luck follows you around when you're on the way out. And lots of people saw that speech and just thought, you know, that is the sign of someone who's basically already lost.
I mean, it really was a comedy of errors, that speech.
Yeah. And I think
it's hard to watch.
I think our press has some, you know, some part to play. You know, when Jeremy Corbyn was making his big speech at the conference, you know, he did this very impressive pose at the end of it where he pointed both hands forwards, and it's probably very good media management by him. But that picture became the front page of every single broadsheet in the country. And Theresa May makes a speech and she's coughing, and you know, every single picture on the front pages is her coughing or the F falling off her sign behind her. But, you know, bad luck is a thing. And in British politics, you know, we have a media that's very kind of flighty. Mm-hmm. They grab onto that kind of thing.
Carlos, I just wonder, though, in terms of maybe the one piece of good luck that endures for Theresa May, as her grip on power and control of her party seems to loosen and loosen hour by hour almost, there isn't another option. Okay, granted, Johnson is still knocking about, but she still seems like the least worst option. Is that likely to enable her to hang on, just because she represents a sort of path of least resistance for the Tories?
I think in the middle of all of her bad luck, she's lucky that there's no other leader in sight for the Conservatives. That's as you just said, I think that's what makes, after that disastrous speech, we've seen calls for her to resign. Some people are arguing, oh, no one resigns because of a bad speech. But it was such a metaphor for everything that has been going on since a referendum to unite the Tories was called, and how disastrous that proved to be.
Well, and then particularly following that up with a completely unnecessary general election.
Yeah, calling a snap election that she had no reason to call. She at least had a majority then. And just showing how, you know, basically no one trusts the policies, the few we see anymore.
I mean, one thing I just wanted to add to that, you mentioned, yeah, that she's lucky that there's no one else around. I think one of the biggest problems in Britain at the moment, and one of the most upsetting things for someone who cares about politics, is that there's such a paucity of talent out there in both main
anywhere
parties.
On the spectrum,
anywhere
or in the
on
centre,
the political
which
spectrum.
Is someone could clean up, couldn't they, Matt?
Absolutely.
Somebody like Matt Alagaya, maybe.
Well, you know, I'm
you
preparing
do
the ground. You know how it is. No, but genuinely, it's so upsetting to see that, you know, the Tories have no one in there who's rising up who you think could be a good leader in a few years' time. Jeremy Corbyn has benefited, I think, largely by being the kind of, the only person who's saying anything unusual in that party. And I mean, it's so sad that young people are kind of jumping on the bandwagon here, because his policies in the main are 30 years old. But because it's new, it's so exciting. But it shouldn't be. I mean, a lot of his policies aren't addressing modern problems. You know, he's got nothing to say about automation or AI.
If you're not a liberal when you're young, you'll never be.
Indeed. Well, only a couple of minutes left, but let's turn briefly to the Nobel Peace Prize. It's been awarded to a campaign against something that's, well, not been too far from the headlines, of course. It went to one of the campaigns to abolish nuclear weapons. Speaking of Jeremy Corbyn, a cause close to his heart, of course. Citing recent tensions with North Korea, the Nobel Committee Chair Berit Rees-Andersen said the risk of nuclear weapons being used today is greater than it's been in a long time. Danny, time is short, but yeah, we talk about North Korea. There are elements that remind you of 1963 and the missile crisis and all this kind of thing. A good decision, and can we read anything into the purpose of the Nobel Peace Prize from this year's winner?
It was a safe choice. I mean, who really wants it to go to someone who wants to blow up the world? I mean, you know, there have been controversial decisions in the past, but I think it's a pretty safe choice. I think they're actually a bit frightened because of, you know, Aung San Suu Kyi got it way back when, and now she's been accused of all kinds of terrible things. So maybe they went for a safe choice this year.
And Carlos, on that precise point that Danny makes there, Aung San Suu Kyi, a lot of people have suggested there's mass signatures being gathered for her to be stripped of the award, to give back the prize money that's associated with this. some people are suggesting that it should only go posthumously to candidates who are dead. I mean, is there some merit to that idea, perhaps?
I think so. And there was a suggestion, I think, on foreign policy saying that it should be limited to it should be awarded 10, maximum of 10 years after someone's death, which would mean that you'd have enough time to evaluate their whole life. But not enough time for people to forget about them and stop being relevant. And I think that's the way to go.
There we go. A bit of a word of wisdom from Carlotta. I hope you're listening, Nobel Committee. That is today's Midori House. Thanks to Carlotta Ribello. Thanks to Daniel Giacopelli. Thanks to Matt Alagaya. Thanks to our programme producer today, Ben Rylan, researchers Yolene Goffin and Katie Watkins, and to our studio manager, Christy Evans. More music next at 1900. Marco Sippi is here with the menu. And there'll be more on the big stories of the day and some of the smaller ones too on the Monocle Daily 2200 here in London. Midori House is back at the same time on Monday. My name is Tom Edwards. Thank you very much for tuning in.